Deuteronomy 24, verses 1 through 4, obviously is a very important passage. We know that it is because it's referred to in both Testaments. Also, we find that it comes in toward the end of the 600 commands in the Law of Moses. The Law of Moses is found in the books Exodus through Deuteronomy. And these commands were given for the Israelites to keep in order to show their evidence their loyalty to God. The Old Testament and these Old Testament commands are a model or paradigm. They're not a complete list of all the things that an Israelite could or should do to please God. I'd like to notice something about Old Testament commands and commands in the Law of Moses before we notice Deuteronomy 24. Of these 600 commands, they can be divided into two different areas. There's what is called an apodictic law. These are laws that start with do or do not. I might give an illustration. We might turn to Leviticus chapter 19 and read verses 9 through 14 to illustrate apodictic laws. When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap your field to its very border. Neither shall you gather the gleanings after your harvest. You shall not strip your vineyard bare. Neither shall you gather the fallen grapes of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and for the sojourner. I am the Lord your God. These are apodictic laws. They start with do or do not. You shall not steal, neither deal falsely, nor lie to one another. And you shall not swear by my name falsely, and so profane the name of your God. I am the Lord. You shall not oppress your neighbor or rob him. The wages of a hired servant shall not remain with you all night until the morning. You shall not curse the dead or put a stumbling block before the blind. But you shall fear your God. I am the Lord. And so these are examples of apodictic laws. These are laws that start with do or do not. But the majority of the 600 commands in the Law of Moses are what are called casuistic laws or hypothetical laws, case-by-case laws, you see. We might give an example of a casuistic law in Deuteronomy chapter 15, beginning with verse 12. The Bible says, if your brother, notice a hypothetical conditional law, it's a case-by-case law. If your brother, a Hebrew man or a Hebrew woman, is sold to you, he shall serve you 6 years. And in the seventh year, you shall let him go free from you. And when you have let him go free from you, you shall not let him go empty-handed. You shall furnish him liberally out of your flock, out of your threshing floor, and out of your wine press, as the Lord your God has blessed you, you shall give to him. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you. Therefore, I command you this today. But if he says, I will not go out from you because he loves you and your household, since he fares well with you, then you shall take an awl and thrust it through his ear into the door, and he shall be your bondman forever. And to the bondwoman you shall do likewise. So, this is an example of a casuistic law, a case-by-case hypothetical law. Here we find that if you are an Israelite, or if you're not an Israelite, or if you don't have at least one slave, this law does not apply to you. Now, this law applies to you only if you are an Israelite, it's conditional, you see, and if you have at least one slave. Now, if you also have a slave who wishes or does not wish to remain with you after the mandatory slave deadline has passed, then this applies to you. Now, if you do not have a slave, if you're not an Israelite, the law does not apply to you. If you are a slave, incidentally, the law only applies to you indirectly because it protects your rights. But it is directed to the owner and it does not apply to everyone. Casuistic laws are case-by-case laws. Now, casuistic laws, as we mentioned, constitute the majority of the 600 commands in the Law of Moses. None of them are explicitly renewed in the New Testament because they apply specifically to Israel's civil, religious, and moral life. Also, by their very nature, they're limited in their applicability, and they're unlikely to apply to a Christian. Now, the law we have under consideration this morning, Deuteronomy 24, verses 1 through 4, is a casuistic law. It's a hypothetical or case-by-case law. And these kinds of laws, incidentally, are introduced by the word if, or when, or supposed that. And the persons spoken about in casuistic laws are spoken of in the third person. This law, incidentally, always invariably has a protasis and an apotasis of a conditional sentence. We'll talk about that in a moment. Now, in exegeting this passage in Deuteronomy 24, verses 1 through 4, a major problem that needs to be solved is the matter of construction. We've already determined that this is a casuistic law. It has a protasis and an apotasis of a conditional sentence. If you studied Greek or another language, you're familiar with those terms. But a major problem is determining where the hypothetical law is in this case, and also where the legal pronouncement begins. Where is the law in Deuteronomy 24, verses 1 through 4? English translations add to the complexity of this problem by translating it in different ways. The King James Version and the American Standard Versions may lead some to believe that the demand of the law is in verse 1, the latter part of verse 1, 1b. In other words, the writing of divorcement is the command of the law. Incidentally, the King James Version and the American Standard Version translated this way because of the Latin Vulgate. They were influenced by the Latin Vulgate. I'd like now to read this passage from the King James Version and notice how it renders this law. When a man hath taken a wife and married her, and it come to pass that she find no favor in his eyes, because he hath found some uncleanness in her, then let him write a bill of divorcement, and give it in her hand, and send her out of his house. And when she is departed out of his house, she may go and be another man's wife. And if the latter husband hate her, and write her a bill of divorcement, and giveth it in her hand, and sendeth her out of his house, or if the latter husband die, which took her to be his wife, her former husband, which sent her away, may not take her again to be his wife. After that she is defiled, for that is an abomination before the Lord. And thou shalt not cause the Lord thy God, thou shalt not cause the land of sin, which the Lord thy God giveth thee for an inheritance. Now both the King James Version and American Standard Versions are liable to the interpretation that, number one, the demand of the law is in verse 1, the latter part of verse 1, the writing of divorcement. They also are liable to the interpretation that a woman is given permission in verse 2 to remarry. When she is departed out of the house, she may go and be another man's wife. And then also, the first husband, according to verse 4, is prohibited from taking back this woman after she has been married to a second man. However, in the Hebrew text, this section begins with a protasis. The conditions are given. And then we have the apotasis in verse 4. Now, we have, first of all, in the Hebrew text, we have a series of conditions that are only connected by the conjunction and. In the Hebrew, the word is wa. The conditions are: this man marries this woman, divorces her, hands her these proper papers to establish the law. Then this woman remarries. It's assumed she may. She's not given permission. She's not told she can't. She remarries. And then third, the second husband divorces her or dies. Finally, you have the apodosis. These are the conditions, the apodosis. This is the law. That first husband may not remarry her. Reunion with her is forbidden. And that's how this passage is set out in the Hebrew text. Also, I'd like to point out that the oldest and most important translation of the Bible, the Hebrew Bible, the Septuagint, renders it this way. The same way as it's rendered in the Hebrew text. We have a prodesis, a series of conditions, subsidiary conditions, and then we have the apodosis given in verse 4. I'd like to read a translation of the Septuagint into English, and you can notice this. When a man taketh a wife and marrieth her, and it come to pass, if she find no favor in his eyes, because he has found some unseemly thing, that he writeth her a bill of divorcement, and sendeth it into her hand, giveth it into her hand, and sendeth her out of his house, and she departeth out of his house, and goeth and becometh another man's wife, and the latter husband hateth her, and writeth her a bill of divorcement, and giveth it into her hand, and sendeth her out of his house, or if the latter husband, who took her to be his wife, die, her former husband, which sent her away, may not take her again to be his wife, after that she has been defiled, for this is an abomination before the Lord, and thou shalt not cause the land to sin, which the Lord thy God giveth thee for an inheritance. So the Septuagint follows the same construction as you'll find in the Hebrew text. A series of conditions. The law is only found in verse 4, in the apodosis. I'd like to read now of the Revised Standard Version and show that the Revised Standard Version and other more modern translations render this like the Septuagint and like it's set out in the Hebrew text. The Revised Standard Version renders it this way. When a man takes a wife and marries her, if then she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some indecency in her, and he writes her a bill of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, and she departs out of his house, and if she goes and becomes another man's wife, and if the latter husband dislikes her and writes her a bill of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, or if the latter husband dies who took her to be his wife, then her former husband, verse 4, who sent her away, may not take her again to be his wife after she has been defiled. For that is an abomination before the Lord. And you shall not bring guilt upon the land which the Lord your God gives you for an inheritance. So the Revised Standard Version, I believe the NIV and New American Standard and several others render it exactly as we've said here, as it's set forth in the Hebrew text and in the Septuagint. Also, modern scholars of all theological persuasions consider that the legal pronouncement, the enactment of the law, is only in verse 4 after this series of conditions. So grammatically, what we have then is in verses 1 through 3, we have the situation, and then we have the conditions. And then verse 4 states the law that must be followed. Verses 1 through 3 do not state the law that must be followed. So therefore, the law of Deuteronomy 24, verses 1 through 4, is not instituting divorce, nor is it prescribing a bill of divorce. Jesus' questioners in Matthew 19, notwithstanding, when they said, why did Moses command a writing of divorce? Jesus said, Moses allowed you to divorce your wives for the hardness of your hearts. No, that this law does not institute divorce. It does not prescribe divorce. Secondly, we can find that there is no permission in verse 2 for the woman to remarry. And then thirdly, we can see that the divorce and the bill of divorce and the second marriage are only conditions. They're only part of the prodesis that must be met before the law is even applicable. Because this is a case-by-case law. It doesn't apply to you if you don't fulfill these conditions. Now, in the situation of Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4, we have three conditions that are to be fulfilled before this law is applicable. And we've already talked about them. First of all, this man takes a wife, marries her, divorces her, hands her these divorce papers to establish this divorce in the law, and then the woman remarries, the second husband then dies or divorces her. Now, although the origin of divorce and its ideal are discussed in Genesis chapter 2, the origin of divorce, the rightness or wrongness of divorce, and also the question of remarriage are not directly discussed in the law of Moses. The origin of divorce, the rightness or wrongness of it, and the question of remarriage are not directly discussed in the Pentateuch. Now, no Hebrew law institutes divorce any more than it does concubinage or polygamy. Divorce is almost as old as the race itself, and it was assumed in Israel, and it was assumed everywhere and recognized in Israel. The husband also seems to have had, before the law of Moses, almost unlimited right to divorce his wife. You remember the story of Abraham and Hagar in Genesis chapter 21. But in the Pentateuch, a priest could not marry a divorced woman. In Leviticus 21, verses 7 and 14, other men likely did marry divorced women. Men also forfeited their right of divorce by certain acts of misconduct. For example, a man who falsely accused his bride-to-be of premarital unchastity could never divorce her, according to Deuteronomy 22. A man who seduced a girl and lay with her, he was required to marry her, and there was no future possibility of later divorce. Deuteronomy 22, 28 and 29. These laws seem to restrict man's previous unlimited right to divorce his wife. The law also did not envision the wife's or the woman's ability or her right to divorce her husband. And it's likely that in Israel this did not occur. Although in some instances, for example, a slave girl who was not given her conjugal rights was allowed to go free. It's not told how this divorce was granted. Probably the details are of her freedom are not given in this law. Probably she appealed to the proper authorities, but still it's the husband who grants her her freedom. Now what I'd like to do is go through the conditions of this law and notice them. First of all, she does not find favor in his eyes. Now this expression, to find favor in one's eyes, is found in Genesis 6, 8, a number of other places I've got written down. It's found at least 45 times for pleasing God in the Old Testament or pleasing man in various ways. It's used negatively only two times. The other time is in Numbers 11, 11. And the male-female attraction is only used here, although there is an element of it in Esther chapter 5 and 7 and 8. But this expression, no favor in the eyes, casts no light that would contribute to the situation that's being described here in verses 1 through 4. The puzzling thing is, phrase is, some unclean thing in her. It comes from the word urba dabar, translated in the Revised Standard Version, some indecency. Literally it means the nakedness of a thing. It's used only two times in the Old Testament. I'm sure you're aware of it. The only other time is in Deuteronomy 23, verse 14. This word for uncleanness or some indecency, urba dabar. But this refers to sanitation. It does not have to do with a moral offense. And so it does not furnish us, the other reference does not furnish us with a clear definition on what the term is here in verse 1. But should someone suggest that it refers to a woman, a wife, that commits adultery, A married woman who is caught committing adultery, the law addresses that. You have your Bibles, we might turn over to Deuteronomy 22 and notice verse 22. If a man is found lying with the wife of another man, both of them shall die, the man who lay with the woman and the woman, so you shall purge the evil from Israel. And so the law requires people in this case to die. Both of them were to die if this married woman is found committing adultery. Well, someone says it might refer to someone who is caught committing adultery, an engaged woman. They haven't been married yet. An engaged woman commits adultery. Then perhaps that's what the uncleanness is. We continue reading in verse 23. The law addresses this. If there is a betrothed virgin, and a man meets her in the city and lies with her, then you shall bring them both out to the gate of that city, and you shall stone them to death with stones. The young woman, because she did not cry for help, though she was in the city, and the man, because he violated his neighbor's wife. So you shall purge the evil from the midst of you. So, in the case of an engaged woman caught in adultery, they were both to be stoned, the law required. What about an engaged woman who was raped? Well, the law addresses this also. In verse 25 of Deuteronomy 22, but if in the open country a man meets a young woman who is betrothed, and the man seizes her and lies with her, then only the man who lay with her shall die. But to the young woman you shall do nothing. In the young woman there is no offense punishable by death. For this case is like that of a man attacking and murdering his neighbor, because he came upon her in the open country, and though the betrothed young woman cried for help, there was no one to rescue her. And so the woman is guiltless in this instance, the man is to die. What about an unengaged woman who lies with a man? Well, let's continue reading in verse 28. If a man meets a virgin who is not betrothed and seizes her and lies with her, and they are found, then the man who lay with her shall give to the father of the young man 50 shekels of silver, and he shall be his wife, she shall be his wife, because he violated her. He may not put her away all his days. So the law here required, if this lady had not been engaged, not been married, and she lies with a man, that she was to they were to be married, this man could never divorce her. Well, someone might suggest that it refers to a married woman who is suspected. Now, up here we find the law addresses a married woman who's caught committing adultery. But what about a married woman who's not found committing adultery, caught committing adultery? What would happen in that instance? Maybe that's the uncleanness. Well, in Numbers chapter 5, we're not going to read this passage. In Numbers 5, 11 through 31, the Bible says that she goes through this certain test, and if she is innocent, the man may never divorce her. But if she's guilty, the Bible says she bears her own guilt, and translators say that her womb would rot out. You remember the incident. But she bears her own guilt, and others suggest that refers to her being stoned, Leviticus 20, verse 10, evidently. In Leviticus 5, verse 1, it talks about bearing your own guilt, and in the case, if she was guilty, she would be threatened by the punishment that God has given. What about a newly married wife that is suspected of premarital unchastity? Well, the law also addresses that. Incidentally, when a man was engaged to a woman under the law, it was just as binding as marriage itself. And that's why up here we find that when a woman who was engaged to a man was found caught in adultery, then she died just as the woman who was married and did the same thing died. But a newly married wife suspected of premarital unchastity. What does the law say concerning this? Verse 13. If any man takes a wife and goes into her and then spurns her and charges her with shameful conduct and brings an evil name upon her, saying, I took this woman, and when I came near her, I did not find in her the tokens of virginity. Then the father of the young woman and her mother shall take and bring out the tokens of her virginity to the elders of the city in the gate. And the father of the young woman shall say to the elders, I gave my daughter to this man to wife, and he spurns her. And lo, he has made shameful charges against her, saying, I did not find in your daughter the tokens of virginity, and yet these are the tokens of my daughter's virginity. And they shall spread the garment before the elders of the city. Then the elders of that city shall take the man and whip him. And they shall find him 100 shekels of silver and give them to the father of the young woman, because he has brought an evil name upon the virgin of Israel. And she shall be his wife, and he may not put her away all his days. But if the thing is true, that the tokens of virginity were not found in the young woman, then they shall bring out the young woman to the door of her father's house, and the men of her city shall stone her to death with stones, because she has wrought folly in Israel by playing the harlot in her father's house. So shall you purge the evil from the midst of you. So the law here requires, if she's guilty, she's to be stoned. If she's not guilty, the man may never divorce her. Bestiality is also addressed in the law. It required death, married or unmarried. Incest also. If you committed incest with the father's wife, death. Daughter-in-law, death. A wife's mother, burned with fire. Sister or half-sister of his father or mother, he was to be cut off from Israel and bear their own iniquity. And then for men, homosexuality is addressed, and the law demanded death. Incidentally, female perversion in this area is not addressed in the law. Being childless was obviously a setback in Israel for a wife. Genesis 16, 1 Samuel chapter 1. And rabbinic rule later recognized that 10 years of childlessness was grounds for divorce. But I believe that Urban DeBar would have to refer to anything other than these punishable acts mentioned. It would have to refer to something other than these punishable acts mentioned, and I know of no other conclusion that anyone can safely take. Now, the lack of specificity in Urban DeBar, some indecency or uncleanness, set the stage for later discussions, rabbinical discussions. You remember the school of Shammai and Hillel discussed this problem, and they assumed that Moses was laying down the basis for divorce, the basis on which divorce might be granted. The school of Shammai put emphasis on erva, and they said it must imply some sort of lewd behavior, or some kind on the part of the woman. But you know, it's interesting that sources extant are not specific as to the kind of behavior that was involved. Now, according to them, it was immorality, but it's not specific. Now, many people today want to go to them and say that they thought it was fornication or premarital unchastity. I'd like a specific reference. Now, they are not specific as to that kind of lewd behavior. Also, there was the school of Hillel. They put emphasis on debar. They did not take erva to mean lewdness, as the other school did, but defect. And they said if a woman burned her bread, that the man had the right to divorce her. And I believe that that was a euphemism that meant other behavior also. But in short, their attitude justified easy divorce. Now, despite these laxities given by the school of Hillel, and perhaps even others, divorce, for the most part, was condemned in Israel. And also, as interesting as these later developments are, these rabbinical theories are on uncleanness, they still must be read back into the original law. So we are without clear definition on erva debar. And I believe we must conclude that it has to include something other than these punishable acts mentioned. The next condition mentioned is he gives her a bill of divorce. Now the Bill of divorce is not an innovation of Deuteronomy. And you'll also notice that this bill of divorce is a part of the prodesis. They are part of the conditions. It is not a part of the law. Now, the purpose of this divorce, some say, was to make the divorce final. It was to keep the husband from reasserting his rights over the woman. And it was also to keep the man from accusing the woman of committing adultery. Now, should she contract another marriage? You know, that was very important in a society where intercourse with a married woman could lead to capital punishment. Got an example of a bill of divorce? I'll read it to you. I'll just use the word blank, on blank day of the week, blank day of the month, blank in the year, blank, I, who am also called the son of blank, of the city of blank, by the river of blank, do hereby consent with my own will, being under no restraint, and I do hereby release, send away, and put aside thee, my wife, blank, who is also called the daughter of blank, who is this day in the city of blank, by the river of blank, who has been my wife for some time past, and thus I do release thee, and send thee away and put thee aside, that thou mayest have permission and control over thyself to go and be married with any man that thou mayest desire, and that no man shall hinder thee from this day forward. And thou art permitted to any man, and this shall be unto thee from me a bill of dismissal, a document of release, and a letter of freedom according to the law of Moses and Israel. And then it's got blank, the son of blank, as a witness, and then blank, the son of blank, as another witness. Two witnesses. The next condition noticed here is that he sends her out of his house. We already pointed out that there is no provision made in the old law for a woman to divorce her husband. And as we said, it's likely that they did not. Although later rabbinical teachings pointed out that if a woman was married to a man that was involved in certain kinds of occupation, he could divorce her. For example, if she found out that he collected certain things from dogs and so forth, he could divorce her. Then they also brought up the discussion on what would happen if she knew before she married him. And they wrestled with that. But anyway, the next condition is she marries another man. You'll notice the rightness or wrongness of this second marriage are not under discussion in this law. Now, where the woman's function and occupation was the wife, it was likely that she would remarry. We don't know if there were unmarried people in Israel by choice, but we do know that later rabbinical teachings condemned unmarried men. Jeremiah seems to be a unique situation. In Jeremiah 10, the next condition is the second man hates her. This is used frequently. This word hate is in the Old Testament to describe man's attitude toward a woman. But it's not necessarily a violent aversion, but it's just simply used as an antithesis to love. Jacob hated Leah, you see, compared to Rachel. Now the point of the law here is, the condition here is that this second husband does not want this woman to continue as his wife. The reason's not given. It's not considered important either. Then, number 7, the second husband divorces her or dies. First of all, the divorce. We have a hypothetical situation again, and it assumes the possibility of divorce with due divorce papers to establish the law, and theoretically, incidentally, this woman is free now to contract a third marriage. Incidentally, the law doesn't even, we'll get to that in a few moments, but she is given theoretically the right to marry a third man. But then also it points out death dissolves the marriage. We have several examples in the Old Testament. David and Bathsheba are an example of this. And you remember David was condemned not for his marriage with her. He was condemned because of the sin he committed with her while she was the wife of Uriah. But anyway, these stipulations, stated as they are, point out that, according to the custom, this woman was available for marriage. Later, rabbinical writers brought up the possibility of complications. What if a man was lost in war, and that happens, you know, and she thought he was dead, and then she remarried, and so forth. They brought up all those possibilities. But now we come to the enactment. We must understand that what we've noticed thus far are conditions of the law. This is a casuistic law, and it's a case-by-case law, and this law right here doesn't apply to you if you're an Israelite, if you don't go through these conditions right here. Now, the law is found, the apodosis is an absolute, permanent prohibition. It is the strongest, it expects the strongest kind of obedience. Suggest that. You shall not take her back. Now, you'll notice here that there's a shift from third person to second person. As we stated, casuistic laws, the persons in these hypothetical or casuistic laws are mentioned in the third person. There's a shift here from third to second person, which grammatically is called an anacoluthon, but it does not soften the prohibition. There's a parallel question also brought up to this law in verse 4. In Jeremiah 3, verse 1, will a man take back a wife? Will a man take back a woman that he has divorced and becomes another man's wife? Would that not greatly pollute the land? God asks here in this scenario. The prophet's answer is here, though man may do so, the Lord can do it. Man may not do so, the Lord can do it with his bride Israel, who played the harlot with many lovers. What is the purpose of this law here in Deuteronomy 24, verse 4, in the apodosis? Several suggestions have been made. Some people say the purpose of this law was to protect the first marriage. In other words, it would remind the man that he ought to be very careful in divorcing the woman, because he might not have an opportunity then to remarry her. But you know, psychologically, I don't believe that someone who is about to divorce his wife is concerned about remarrying her. And so, also, you'll notice that the law does not prohibit him from remarrying her if she hasn't remarried a second time and been divorced, you see. So the law doesn't even prohibit him from remarrying her. It says nothing about that. Some say, well, this law is given to protect the second marriage. In other words, if he divorces her in a fit of anger and then she remarries, it would keep them from rekindling that flame, you see. It would keep him and her from plotting the death of this second husband or plotting the divorce from that second husband. But there must be another reason behind the law besides wife swapping. Let's go to the text and see what the law says. What are the three reasons given to us in the law on why this law should be obeyed? First of all, the woman is defiled as far as her first husband is concerned. The law of Moses also pointed out that sexual relations with one who was to whom one was not entitled, such as a neighbor's wife, Leviticus 18:20, defiles. A woman with whom relations is had also, Numbers 5, is said to be defiled. But the first purpose given, the first reason for this law is she is defiled as far as that first husband is concerned. Secondly, for him to take her back is an abomination in the sight of the Lord. This word occurs 116 times as a noun, 23 times as a verb. And it covers a variety of acts under the old law. For example, it refers to food prohibitions in Deuteronomy 14, idolatrous practices, Deuteronomy 7, the practice of magic, Deuteronomy 18, sexual offenses, Leviticus 18, transvestite clothing, Deuteronomy 22, ethical wrongs, Deuteronomy 25. But you know something common to all of these uses is the notion of irregularity. The act, in other words, offends the accepted order, ritual, or morals. And so Deuteronomy 24, verses 1 through 4, states that God is offended if this prohibited act should take place. The third reason given in this passage is that this makes the land to sin. Israel's king, Jeroboam, you remember, is stated throughout for causing the land to sin. The land here is personified. It's spoken of as sinning. God gave the land to Israel. We noticed this Monday morning. And this is a frequent idea. Deuteronomy 4, verse 21. And unchastity defiles the land. This is frequently stated. Leviticus 18, 25. Also, we find that murder makes the land to sin. Defiles the land. Numbers 35. When you leave a man hanging, it does. Deuteronomy 21. Idolatry does. Psalm 106. And when you come in contact with corpses, all those also pollute the land. So a study of this passage shows that the rabbis were on the wrong track. A study of this passage shows that this passage was not teaching on the conditions for divorce. It was not instituting divorce, was not prescribing divorce, but it was simply prohibiting remarriage with a divorced woman who had in the meantime been married to another man. And it's little wonder why Jesus, when the Pharisees brought this up, without disputing the presuppositions of his audience, went back to the original ideal for marriage in Genesis chapter 2.